Okay. So, again, were you to take the people who run the Immunodeficiency Foundation, they would say that there are inherited complement deficiencies, that they're life-threatening, and they're very rare. In fact, a paper appeared a few months ago which said they surveyed all of the complement deficiencies in Europe, all of them, and they found 23 patients. Now, the question is, how do you define a complement deficiency? And the way it came out, or the way it has come out, the way people think about it, is we know that a bunch of proteins are important in one system or another, and we look for somebody missing the protein. That is the way we define complement deficiencies and all deficiencies at this meeting. So I'm going to go into this, and I'm going to try to keep it at a relatively understandable level, which isn't so easy. And then maybe you'll be one of the people who goes out and says to the company, why don't you try to make one of these drugs? And I'll explain why it's important. So first of all, complement is an element of innate immunity. What is innate immunity? Well, when we talk about T cells and B cells and agammaglobulinemia, we're talking about acquired immunity. That is, you make a response to a vaccine or to an infection, and you become immune. But every animal that goes way back has to protect itself from infection. And acquired immunity, what we just talked about, only arises in evolution at about the level of the fish. So animals that are more primitive than fish don't make antibodies. They don't make B cells and T cells. That's something that evolution learned to do as you develop. But there are all kinds of things to keep you from getting infection. So all animals have the skin, and that skin keeps the infection out. And then they have all this long list of cells that helps prevent infection. They have receptors on those cells. They have things inside the cells that they can pour out on the infectious agent to kill it, and they have various factors. And we can talk about that if anybody has any questions, but you can see, you can spend 2 hours talking about that. Now, this is a slide that deals with the issue that I was just dealing with. So, if you take very primitive animals, they basically have immunity, but they can't make antibody. Until you get to the level of the fish, you don't have the ability to make antibody. But there are much more primitive creatures. I'm showing a horseshoe crab here. I'm showing a sea urchin. They protect themselves from infection. And these proteins that we talked about, the complement proteins, are present in all of these animals. The reason that a mosquito does not get killed by a malaria organism is complement. Now, complement's been known for 100 years. It's actually been known longer than adaptive immunity. And people were only interested in one particular question. What does complement do to protect you against infection, including bacterial infection? And what we learned, and there's a man at this meeting called Hans Ox. I just wrote a chapter for him on the history of complement. And so this history starts in 1890. But what we learned during this century was that complement basically does three things to protect you from infection. The first is it's learned to poke holes in the surface of cells, and this shows a hole like a cork borer being poked in a bacterium. That's the first thing it does. The second thing it's learned to do is to deposit pieces of itself, protein fragments, on the surface of the organism. That matches up with receptors on phagocytic cells. They can hold on to this bacterium, swallow it, and kill it. And the third thing it does is it basically gets activated, pieces come off, and those pieces tell these cells how to behave. So this is a cell called a neutrophil. It actually changes its direction, and it migrates toward the bacterium that's activated complement. It changes its shape, and it's in better shape to kill that bacterium. We've known this for a good part of this century. Now, I had to deal with the question of how does complement work in viral diseases? And the way people study this is they take a mouse that's missing one complement protein or another, and they infect it with a virus or a bacterium that they know how it works, and they look to see if the animal dies faster. That's the end of the research. And in 5 minutes, I was able to put together this list of viruses, etc. Now, the interesting thing about this is nobody's interested in it. This is not an area of hot research in America at the present time. The reason is, as I said, everybody's got complement. It's almost never that somebody's missing one of these proteins. And so an infectious disease specialist doesn't really have to worry about it. He knows the system's okay. He knows vaguely that the system, if it's not okay, is a problem. But he knows that his patient's chance of having a problem is infinitely small, and so he doesn't worry about it. So here is an idea of how complement works, experiment that we did a long time ago, and this has to do with pneumococci, which is the organism that causes pneumonia in many of our kids. If you take pneumococci, and this was done in a guinea pig, and you actually inject the pneumococci into the blood of the animal, it gets cleared very quickly. There's a little period of recrudescence. There's definitive clearance. If you've done something to the complement system, it starts to get cleared, it overgrows, and it kills the animal. So I can prove to you that complement is very important. I can prove to you that it's important in all those infections. And what we'll talk about in a little while is that I can prove to you that it's important in a large number of diseases in man, and I can't prove to you that any drug companies are interested. This is the picture I showed you before. I just put in a slide to show you 1, 2, and 3. So 1 was the whole, and this is a picture of a surface, and you can see the cork borer very clearly. It's actually clearer in the bottom picture. You can see that the complement has oriented itself in the surface, and it's just like a cork borer. Things can go right through the center, and of course the organism can't keep itself alive with its inside and outside in contact, and it dies. So that was number 1. Number 2 is opsonization. Here are cells, red cells in this case, coated with complement, and they stick to the cell in the middle because it has complement receptors. This is one step in the phagocytic process, and the second step causes the red cells to go inside. So that's the second job that complement does. And the third job, I said, is that it causes chemotaxis. It causes things to come toward where the complement is being generated. That's number 3. And here's an example of this happening. In this blood vessel, immune complexes have been allowed to activate complement, and you can see all the white cells crowding in. Now, were you to give this to a human pathologist, he would say this is vasculitis. So, in fact, in many cases, vasculitis is caused by complement. Again, nobody studies this. Now, there are 3 pathways of complement activation that have been described. This is not my slide, but it makes a point. There's something called the classical pathway. Remember, we talked about C1 and C1 inhibitor and hereditary angioedema. And the reason this is called the classical pathway is people started studying it in 1890. They didn't know that there were any other pathways until much more recent times. Now, I've reassorted this slide in the next slide, and it's going to make it confusing, and I'm sorry. I tried to straighten it out in such a way that things would flow from one to another, and it looked like it was going to take me many, many more hours than it was worth. But basically, there are proteins that get activated in the system that cause the kinds of things that we just talked about. So this is a slide that I made, and you can see it's a hell of a lot more confusing. But here again is the classical pathway, and this is the C1 that we talked about, and we talked about it cleaving C4 and that being used as a diagnostic test for hereditary angioedema. And the only other point that I want to make, and anybody has a question? Yeah?
Finish what you're
okay, is that a series of proteins are in your blood. Every single person in this room has every single one of these proteins. And almost nobody missing anything. And it goes through C3, 5, there's a protein called C6, C7, C8, C9, and when you get to the end, you get to that cork borer and you get lysis. C3 is the main protein that causes what is called opsonization, putting those little fragments on the cells so that they start the phagocytic process that we talked about. And the third one is chemotaxis, and that's C5. Now, what was your question? Sure. So that's the classical pathway. And as I said, the reason it's called the classical pathway is people asked the question in 1890 when they first discovered antibody, what does antibody do? And they couldn't find antibody doing anything until there was fresh serum around, and that fresh serum contained complement, and they started to work out this pathway, and they called it the classical pathway. Now, it turns out in evolution, the classical pathway works with antibody. And antibody, as I said, is a relatively recent development in evolution, and it turns out the classical pathway is not evolutionarily old. The two old pathways are the one at the top called the lectin pathway and the one at the bottom called the alternative pathway. Let's take the alternative pathway first because it's easier to explain. The alternative pathway has that brilliant name because people discovered it and said, hey, it's an alternative pathway. So it's a pathway that comes in at the level of C3. It uses its own series of proteins, which are exactly analogous to the proteins of the classical pathway. And it's a different pathway that comes in at the level of C3, and it has some differences. The first one is that it's evolutionarily old. It's one of these pathways that goes way, way back, and it doesn't require antibody. It would have to not require antibody, since antibody hadn't evolved at the time that the pathway evolved. And the lectin pathway was the last pathway to be discovered. And it was discovered when people found that there were ways that the complement pathway could be activated by just things like yeast and bacteria. And when they started to look, they found this very old pathway, doesn't require antibody, uses, again, a series of proteins, which we can talk about, that join the classical pathway, that continue along the classical pathway, to give you all of the biological features. Now, you'll notice that all three pathways are together at the level of C3, and all three pathways are together at the level of all the proteins after C3, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. So they can all cause lysis in the right circumstances. If you pick up a textbook at the present time, you'll see that all three pathways do the same thing. One of the focuses of my research is to prove that, in fact, they don't all do the same thing. And we can talk about that, but it's certainly not something that we're going to develop an understanding of here. As I said, this is complicated, and now it gets more complicated. And the reason is, suppose you decided that you're going to kill things in your house. And suppose you decided that you're going to use a bottle of nitroglycerin to kill some mice. And you're going to keep 3 or 4 bottles of nitroglycerin around the house. You probably would think that you want to spend some time thinking about how to prevent them from blowing up. That you probably want to figure out how to turn this thing off. I showed you a bunch of ways in which complement kills things. I showed you it plugs holes in things. I showed you it opsonizes things. I showed you it causes chemotaxis. Now, it turns out that there are a fair number of diseases in man in which complement is doing exactly that. So if you happen to be one of the unlucky people who develops autoimmune hemolytic anemia, Kathleen Sullivan's going to talk about some of the patients with immunodeficiency who do develop autoimmune hemolytic anemia. It's often complement that's causing the autoimmune hemolytic anemia. It's coating your red cells. They're sticking to phagocytes that recognize the complement fragments and swallowing them. And so, in fact, you got yourself a problem. The system is doing what it's supposed to do, but it's not supposed to be killing your own cells. So you have a very large number of ways of turning it off. And that's shown on this slide. And we've started to think about the ways of turning it off really only in the last decade. So everything in red and green on this slide is a way of turning it off. And there are as many ways of turning it off as there are of turning it on. So we talked about C1 inhibitor when we talked about hereditary angioedema. It actually turns off both the lectin pathway and the classical pathway, although that has nothing to do with the pathophysiology of hereditary angioedema. But then there are all these other proteins that turn off the complement system. Some of them are in your plasma, and the ones in green are actually attached to your cells. And they all turn off the complement pathway. And the lightning bolts are places where the proteins, if they land on something, are only stable for a few minutes. If they continue the complement cascade, it goes. If they don't continue the complement cascade, they degrade and, in fact, go downhill. And you can see there are lots of places where this system can be turned off. Now, it turns out that although we have patients missing complement proteins, they're extraordinarily rare. I said 23 in Europe. But there are a lot of people who have a problem with turning things off. And that turns out to be much more common than we knew. I put in some slides about the various complement pathways, and probably they're less interesting than some of the other things that we can talk about. But I'll go through them very quickly. This is the classical pathway. I talked about C1. Here is a picture of C1Q that attaches to the antibody. It has a central stalk. It has little places here that attach to the antibody, and it continues the complement cascade. You asked about the lectin pathway. Here is the protein that turns on the lectin pathway, and here is C1Q. They look an awful lot alike. The only difference is that this one recognizes antibody. I said that antibody has evolved at the time that this pathway evolves. This one doesn't recognize antibody because it evolved before antibody, so it has these little things at the end that recognize sugars, and so it recognizes various sugars on the surface of organisms like yeast and some bacteria, and it starts off the complement cascade. This is less efficient than actually recognizing antibody, and so, in fact, this pathway has become vestigial, basically. It's not as important a pathway, and we're still only working it out. This pathway was only rediscovered in the 1990s, and in the year 2000 and 2015, exactly what it does, we still don't know. So we talked about the classical pathway, antibody usually required. We developed a line of guinea pigs years ago missing C4. And the reason that I wanted to present these animals to you is that the same discovery has been made in mice missing C4, and Hans Ochs, who's at these meetings, did a very limited number of patients missing C4. That's a very hard experiment to do. I've never seen a patient missing C4. And that means that the ones that are discovered are almost always sick. But if you look at animals missing C4, you find animals missing C1, C4, C3 all have a defect in their ability to make antibody. And remember, that's the pathway that evolves at the time the antibody evolves. This is our guinea pigs missing C4. And Hans Ochs has a method of giving a particular antigen to animals or people. We use it in children. And what happens when you give this antigen as a vaccine, basically they make antibody. Over weeks, the antibody declines slightly. You boost them. That is, you give a second shot of the antigen. This particular experiment was done at 7 weeks, and you get a secondary response, which is IgG, and this is a log scale. This is much higher, and it comes down. This is what happens every time you give a vaccine to a child. If you do it in an animal that's missing complement, we discovered years ago that the animal makes a response which is really a tenth, the normal response, and then it doesn't hold on. It goes back down to zero, stays at zero. You boost the animal 7 weeks later, it makes a response that looks like the first response. We know that this is true. We know that it's true in guinea pigs. We know it's true in dogs. We know it's true in mice. And in the very few people that have been studied, it looks like it's true in humans. I'm not going to go through. That's missing just one protein, C4. As I said, I've never seen a patient missing C4. They're described, but I'm a complement expert. I've never, ever seen a patient. I've never seen a patient missing C1Q. I've only seen one patient in my life missing C3. So we're talking about very rare deficiencies. What?
C3.
You missing C3?
Yeah, it's really low all the time.
That's different from missing it, but we'll talk after the end of this. Yeah, we'll talk about it. Because remember, you have two C3 genes, and one of them can be abnormal. We'll talk about that at the end of the session. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time on these complement pathways. People still are not sure of what the lectin pathway does. There are papers. First of all, it's not being studied in America, I think, by anybody at the present time. That's the first thing. It is being studied by the Europeans who have worked on it. And in fact, they claim that the incidence of infection in little babies is a little bit higher in people missing this lectin pathway. Remember, this is a vestigial pathway. And there are a fair number of people who have very low levels of proteins in the lectin pathway. And it's not clear that they're at risk for anything. Again, there's a question of, do they have an increased risk of rheumatologic disease? This woman is low on C3. The usual level of C3 in the circulation is 1.2 milligrams per mil. The usual level of the first protein in lectin pathway is a thousandth that. And you have to have nanogram levels before they say it's low. So in fact, we're talking about a protein that circulates at a thousandth the level of C3, and we don't really know exactly what it does. There are more and more papers saying it does something important, it probably does, but it's not so easy to study. And as I say, the popularity of this area is not so great. Infectious disease people don't worry about it. They think people who have lectin pathway deficiencies are perfectly normal, and nobody would ever think about replacing it. So, in fact, it's not studied. This is the lectin picture I showed you before. The alternative pathway does not require antibody. It has proteins. For the purpose of this slide, I showed you that the proteins are analogous to the proteins of the classical pathway. We don't have to go into that in detail. But the alternative pathway is very primitive, gets activated, and is probably most involved in things like the development of arthritis, in the development of kidney disease. It's probably most involved in the development of immunopathology. That is all of the bad things that happen when your immune system goes awry. So it's important, but as I say, getting a company to actually work on this stuff is not so easy. But at the end of the talk, I'll talk about the one drug that has come along that is useful in common. There's only one drug. It's a monoclonal antibody. We talked about what a monoclonal antibody is. It's a monoclonal antibody to C5. And you can give this drug to people who have some diseases, which we can talk about, and it turns off their C5. What that means is it turns off everything after C5, which means it turns off lysis. This is a company called Alexion. It sells the drug for $500,000 a year. It's turned out to be life-saving for some diseases. And since they're making a fair amount of profit on this drug, they're trying it in other diseases like graft rejection, and it's turning out to be useful in those diseases as well. But nobody would have known it until they developed the protein. As I said, it's the only protein that's currently available for treatment of a complement disorder. So we talked about all of this. That's C5. So what does C5 do? C5 gets cleaved, like all the complement proteins, into a big piece and a little piece. The little piece is called C5A, and it acts as an anaphylatoxin. What does that mean? Well, if you give a big slug of it to an animal, the animal dies. It looks like anaphylaxis. It's the principal chemotactic factor, the thing that makes those cells come into the vessel I showed you, a vessel filled with white cells. It upregulates so-called adhesion molecules that allows things to stick together. It makes the cells make cytokines, which improves the immune response and can increase immunopathology, and it causes mast cells to degranulate, and that's why it's an anaphylatoxin. When mast cells degranulate en masse, you get something called anaphylaxis because they release a whole bunch of stuff that can kill you. That's what an asthmatic attack is, mast cells degranulating and releasing all these factors. We're doing time-wise. We're doing okay. So this is a human being, and we've injected C5A into the skin, and you can see something that looks like a hive, and it itches like mad. And in fact, if you were to biopsy it, which we did, it's full of white cells. So in fact, it's part of the allergic response. Turns out it's important in a lot of other things that people are just starting to work out. But again, the number of people doing this kind of stuff is very small. This is something that was done 25 years ago. This is called a Boyden chamber. And what they do is they put a millipore filter here in the chamber. They can put C5A down here. It's at the bottom of the chamber. They can put white cells at the top of the chamber, and they can see what happens. And in fact, if you put white cells at the top of the chamber and just buffer at the bottom, those white cells start to migrate through the millipore filter. But if you put C5A down here, they go through much faster. They go to the bottom of the filter. They start to drop off. And so you can see chemotaxis in action. In fact, this was a popular experiment 25 years ago. I've never seen anybody doing it anymore. If you take an animal, this is a normal lung, and you give it an enormous slug of C5A, this is the vessel in the rabbit's lung, and in fact the rabbit dies. Now how was this discovered? Very interesting. It turns out that there was a group in Minnesota that was interested in, not in complement at all, they were interested in heart-lung membranes, they were interested in kidney dialysis membranes, and a certain proportion of their patients were getting terribly sick with lung disease during the attack. And so what happened was that they started to figure out what's going on. And what they figured out was that these very primitive complement pathways that recognize sugars were recognizing the dialysis membrane, activating complement, and in causing this pulmonary problem in people. So the problem was discovered in people. It was worked out in people. And then we went back to animals, so these people were not interested in complement at all. But they really did figure out that they have to worry about complement in dialysis membranes and heart-lung machine membranes. And so that's all tested at the present time, and people have worked out ways of preventing it. We've talked about the C5A 5 to 9. There are a few people missing 5 to 9, almost nobody missing any of the other proteins in the classical alternative pathway. In fact, there are some proteins in the alternative pathway, and then no one has ever been found to be missing. But in fact, if you're missing 5 to 9, you can get meningococcal or gonococcal infection, and so that's been noted. I'm trying very hard to go through this in a way that's very meaningful. And I'm having mixed. Oh, I know why. Okay. Now, this is a picture of antibody being deposited in somebody's kidneys. It's a disease called glomerulonephritis. And we've known about this disease for 50 years, but nobody knows what causes glomerulonephritis. Nobody knows for sure how to treat glomerulonephritis. It's really been a mystery. Often this is complement in the kidney, and this is the kidney of somebody with lupus. So, in fact, nobody knows what causes lupus, and nobody knows for sure how to treat lupus. We give people steroids, we give people things to kill their B cells so that they don't make antibody, but nobody knows for sure how to treat it. And all of a sudden, things have started to clarify. One of the things that turned out to be interesting is that patients who are missing the proteins of the classical pathway that I've circled, that basically arise at the time, well, they start to arise at the time that antibody arises, but they're intimately involved with antibody. If you're one of the few people missing those proteins, and I mean missing, I don't mean low levels, you have a very high incidence of autoimmune disease. In fact, I've never seen a patient missing C1q deficiency, but almost 100% of the people that have been described missing C1q deficiency have severe lupus, very severe lupus. 75% of the people with C4 deficiency have severe lupus. Now, we're talking about less than 100 people. We're talking about almost nobody. And how do you find these people? Well, it turns out that you go to places where people marry their cousins. You don't find it in the American population. And as you can see, the other factors are not associated with autoimmunity. So what does all that mean? God knows. And I'll just skip this slide because it basically says the same thing. Now, this is a very complicated slide, and I'm not going to spend time with it. It was just published in, as you can see, actually it was published in 2013, so it's not very old. But it makes the point that complement is made by certain cells. And if those cells, if you have complement, and the cells have the appropriate receptors for C3A and C5A, lots of cells have those receptors. We talked about the fact that if C3A and C5A binds to mast cells, they degranulate. So if the cells have the appropriate receptors, they go ahead and make an immune response. If the cells have figured out how to get rid of the receptors, and it turns out that cells can figure out how to get rid of the receptors, you turn off the immune response. Now, this has been published, as I say, the most recent paper was in 2012. I can tell you that if I go to the Department of Immunology at Duke University or almost any other Department of Immunology, they don't even know what I'm talking about. So, in fact, this is very recent stuff. But it may have a tremendous impact in the near future. Now, we talked about anti-C5, and we said that it's approved by the FDA. It's in all kinds of phase two trials, and basically it works very well in a group of patients who are missing this particular factor, which works at the very end of the complement cascade. This is just one protein. It's called CD59. And it turns off complement at the very last step before lysis. Turns out there are a few people missing CD59. It's an acquired defect. It's not inherited. You can't live if it's inherited. There's only one person ever been described with it. But in fact, there are a group of people who develop hematologic disease in their bone marrow who lose the CD59. You can lose lots of different things on your cells in the bone marrow. And if you lose CD59, you lose the ability to turn off lysis. And that's what the eculizumab does. It turns things off at this point here, so they never get to CD59. It turns out to be life-saving in those patients. So those patients who have a terrible disease pay $500,000 a year. They get CD59. They get their complement system turned off, and their cells don't lyse. That's important. As I said, it's being tested in a lot of other diseases. Now, we've talked about all these control factors. And as people have learned more and more about genetics, they've learned more and more about these control factors. And so I wanted to make a point. This on the left is a series of amino acids like M&Ms, all different colors, in a chain. And that chain associates into a complex structure, which is the way your proteins work. And I showed you a picture earlier of hereditary angioedema, of C1 inhibitor, very complex protein with squiggles and turns and all things connected to one another. Now, suppose you're not missing this protein, but suppose this green circle turns to a different amino acid, it's blue. One of the things that can happen is you don't make the protein anymore. It turns out that that's such a lethal change that, in fact, the protein is not made. It turns out that that doesn't happen in complement very often. What happens is that the protein works, but it doesn't work quite as well as it used to work. So you still wind up with this very complex protein, but there's one spot in it that's not working quite as well. And it turns out that people have evolved in such a way that a lot of those control proteins that we talked about can be abnormal. Again, very complex slide. I don't know how to make it simple. But there's a disease called atypical hemolytic uremic syndrome, which is in children, which is a kidney and hemolytic disease. And people were interested in trying to figure out what in the world that was all about. And now you can do very complex genetic analyses. And when they did that, what they found was that things that turn off C3, I'm sorry, hard to do it without a good pointer. Here is C3. These factors, as I told you before, turn off C3. Anything that turns off C3 that's not working right, and some of these factors turn off C3, will allow C3 to be more active. And if C3 is more active, you wind up with it depositing in your glomerulus, and in fact, you can get hemolytic uremic syndrome, your kidneys get destroyed. On the other hand, it turns out that some of those tiny little changes make some of these proteins more active. And in fact, there are some people walking around who have turned out to have these one tiny little amino acid changes, and their factor B, for example, became more active. And particularly if these factors allow one of your proteins to become more active, and another change allows one of the inhibitors to become less active. These are tiny changes. But in fact, you've suddenly got yourself a disease. Now, the people who discovered this really were not interested in complement. They were interested in these diseases. And one of the most interesting facts is that to determine whether all this stuff is working normally requires a tremendous amount of work. Think about it, all the genetic changes you have to study. Because, in fact, if you investigate a typical patient, these are all mutation screenings for things that turn off or turn on complement. These are protein levels that you really have to do. There's an awful lot of work that has to be done to determine whether a patient has one of these abnormalities, and almost nobody's in position to do it. In fact, there's only one laboratory in America that will do this for you. And it's run by a guy who's a professor of otolaryngology at a school in the Midwest. Well, why in the hell would a patient of otolaryngology set up to do all these mutations, particularly since he didn't have any interest in complement? And the answer was his kid developed a disease. So, in fact, he had to find somebody to do it. I'm very emotional. And anyway, he does all these things, but it costs a lot of money. So what do you do? Well, he'll do it as a favor for a few people, but he won't do it for everybody. So it turns out that if you... Now there's a disease in man called macular degeneration of the elderly. And macular degeneration of the elderly is, again, a disease that causes blindness. It's the most common cause of blindness in the elderly. And there had been no understanding of this disease. Now, again, nobody in America was interested in complement, but a lot of people were interested in doing genetic screening. And so, in fact, they started to screen families of patients with macular degeneration of the elderly. And what they found was, and four papers got published in the same month, a tyrosine 402 to histidine in one of the complement regulatory factors. And that seemed to be associated with 50% of macular degeneration of the elderly. As they started to study people with macular degeneration of the elderly, they found the same set of defects, again, tiny amino acid changes, in a lot of the proteins that control complement activation. That was discovered probably 5 or 6 years ago, and people are still trying to figure out how that works. But they know this. They know that in this, let's just look at this side. They know that this is complement deposited in the so-called macula, the place that gives you the sharpest vision. And this complement deposited in macular degeneration of the elderly. Exactly why it got there is not clear. But it is clear that the factor H, for example, is one of the factors that leads to control of that activation. And all of these other defects they're finding are the same defects that they're finding in glomerulonephritis. Now, as they've looked at more common kinds of glomerulonephritis, they're also finding complement defects. Now, do you call this an immunodeficiency? It's not immunodeficiency in the sense that we've been talking about, that they're talking about next door. I mean, they're talking about a gene defect in the ability to handle microorganisms that leads to chronic granulomatous disease. Or they're talking about a gene defect that leads to Wiskott-Aldrich syndrome. They're talking about a gene defect that leads to loss of a gene. And it's a lot easier to find a gene defect that leads to a loss of disease. Now we're talking about a gene defect that leads to a tiny amino acid change. And that tiny amino acid change, if it's a present and some of your other proteins have a tiny amino acid change, you've got a problem. How do you correct the problem? Well, it's not clear at the present time, and people are just working this out at the present, as I said. As I said, there's only one company that's bothered to even make a drug to control the complement activation side if the control downregulation is abnormal. And that's Alexion, which makes anti-C5. It's the only company. Alexion is a good stock. It has really done very well. Another guy who was the head of rheumatology at Colorado got a great idea. He said, suppose I take some of these complement control proteins and hook them up with something that'll bring them to the site where the damage is taking place, like arthritis. Will that help? And the answer is it does. And again, the Alexion studies have been done in people now. The arthritis studies and the glomerulonephritis studies have only been done in mice. This guy quit his job for 1 year. He took a leave of absence. He started a company. And guess what? Alexion bought the company. And so maybe we'll find out something more in the near future. But there's a lot of opportunity here, and a lot of opportunity that companies are afraid to put money into to sort of test out. Alexion's been the only company that's taken a chance. I suspect that we'll see some more in the future. But this is an area of immunodeficiency which you won't hear about in any other sessions. And so it's I think, of interest, and it's certainly of interest to me. Now, if you have a complement genetic defect, no protein, you have a complement titer of zero, we won't get into that. Multiple proteins low, we think about an acquired defect, and that is if your C3 is low, your C4 is low. We can talk about your C3 being low. And then there are useful tests that look for genetic deficiencies. The problem is that with regulatory deficiencies, it's much harder to diagnose. We still don't have a good system in place in America for doing that. In case you have C1 inhibitor deficiency, you're in Fat City, because, in fact, we know exactly what to do. And all these diseases on this chart are in some way related to complement. We know that all these diseases are associated with complement activation. We know that people with rheumatoid arthritis have activated complement in their joint fluid. We know that people with dermatomyositis and certain kinds of encephalitis have complement activation. We know that myasthenia gravis is due to complement activation. Alzheimer's lesions do have complement deposited. Nobody's sure what that means. You can look down this long list. It's a long list. There are no drugs to control any one of the steps on this list at the present time. And no near future drugs, except in the renal diseases, where suddenly the nephrologist is saying, hey, wait a minute, maybe we missed the boat. So I have the last slide. And I'm open for questions.